science.
Time to hold this week's big stories in science up to the light, to some scrutiny. My guest on Research Filter tonight is Dr. Will Grant from the Australian National Centre for the Public Awareness of Science, and I'm feeling very publicly aware tonight. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Patricia.
Now, RM Breakfast covered this amazing research on Tuesday that I have been wanting to talk about all week, about the island-hopping migration routes planned out and taken by the first people to arrive in Australia 50,000 years ago. Will, you wanted to delve deeper into it. How did scientists work this out?
Look, yeah, I'm with you on this. I love this study. I think it's awesome. And I think it's fascinating to think about the very first migration to Australia, or what was, archaeologists call it Sahul, because it's a bigger continent. It includes Papua New Guinea and connects Tasmania into mainland Australia. But yes, this is a fascinating study looking at what really was necessary to get these first migrants to land on the Australian mainland. So obviously we don't know exactly what happened here. This is a reconstruction based on a couple of bits of evidence. So one of the key bits here is an understanding based on a variety of different population dynamics. So looking at sort of fertility of peoples around that time, longevity, the food that was available in the area, the climate and all of those kinds of things, to work out what sort of size group you would need to actually establish a population. Now, obviously, we know a population was established, so we have to work backwards from there and think, okay, what could it be? Now, there is obviously, you know, the ideas of, okay, could it have been a tiny group, a family group or something like that, you know, a few people, a dozen people, one canoe or something like that. Or possibly, you know, there's the speculated right down one end, you know, there's one pregnant woman is a theoretical position. But to actually establish a population, we need a much larger group than that. So looking at these sorts of dynamics, it seems we probably needed about 1,300 people. Or over 1,000 people.
How did they arrive at that figure, though?
Yeah, look. Well, one of the things that we've had in the past, this is a very different story. But many thousands of years before that, there was a period in which the human race got down to a number like that. And we've looked at a lot of population genetics from a lot of different animals, so similar animals and different sorts of species. And once you get lower than that sort of level, then you reduce the genetic diversity that you have, and suddenly it becomes very hard to mitigate against a lot of diseases and to cope with shocks. So that when you see populations fall below those sorts of levels, particularly looking at breeding pairs and things like that. I mean, breeding pairs is a weird way to talk about humans.
Yeah, I was cracking up when you said that. Breeding pairs. Hello, pair of breeders.
But once we get below those sorts of levels, you know, couples having kids, that often the sad end is extinction. We get lower than that and you tend not to have species surviving. So the same thing happens, obviously, not just at the global level, but at a local level. When you get interbreeding groups of people, when you get lower than those sorts of numbers, then you don't tend to survive. Now, there are obviously different ways that could happen, but looking at sort of the time and the hunter-gatherer societies that were likely to happen then, this is the likely sort of number of people, which, you know, suggests actually that's a pretty big migration. Hmm. That's quite a number of people actually setting out to cross what is has been well established in the past, one of the most difficult sea routes for early peoples. So this is suggesting it really must have been a planned migration.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. All right, let's move to a couple of the other ones as we bump towards the news. The London School of Economics and Political Science, Will, researchers reckon divorce has a tendency to make children put on weight, especially in kids under six. Wow. How did they land on those findings?
Yeah, look, this is a really, it's a sad story. What they've got here is looking at a large cohort of children, so about 7,500 children who were born between 2000 and 2002, and they, in these large cohort studies, this is called the Millennium Cohort Study in the UK, and they're looking at all sorts of developmental indicators, how they're doing at school, how they're doing in terms of health and all those kinds of things, and then tracking a lot of those demographic factors, looking at these children every so often. So they looked at them at 9 months, then 3 years, five, seven, so on, like that. Now, within that cohort of children, obviously, you would expect there would be a range of different situations in family and a lot of different things happen. So about a fifth of the children saw their parents separate by the time they were 11, which that's just population statistics. then what you can then do is compare those children with their the cohort next to them who didn't see their parents go through divorce. And it seems like they are likely to experience significant overweight or obesity in the future, in the 24 months after the separation or the 36 months after the separation.
So these families are already going through a pretty hard time. Are the researchers offering any solutions to this?
Well, this is the thing. What they want to do is say, okay, this is the time for intervention. So they're saying, look, probably some of the reasons, and we can guess a lot of these reasons. Some of them are very structural. So things like there's probably likely to be less money in the house. So maybe eating less healthily, eating less fresh fruit and vegetables, less money for extracurricular activities. But similarly, also less time around. If it's either one parent or juggling between two different households, there's less time to establish those healthy eating habits and less time to prepare nutrition. Food. Now, obviously, not blanket statements at all. These are just averages and potentially some sort of emotional reaction. So what they're saying is this is a window now where we should probably say, okay, let's look for interventions here. What can we do to support the children in these sorts of situations so that maybe they can get those healthier eating practices or continue on with sport or whatever it is that might help in this situation?
We've only got a minute left, but everyone knows, and if you don't, I'll let you know. I have a cavoodle called Bindi who rules our house. Got to get onto that. When she looks at me, she has these little sweet little puppy dog eyes. It's because she gets me, right? Is there something else going on here?
Look, it could well be. Look, I have a deep belief that dogs have evolved to smile at us, look at us in a certain way to pretend like they understand us. Maybe they actually do. This study has looked at the eye muscles comparing dogs and wolves, and it seems like dogs, those separated from wolves 10,000 years ago or something like that, have evolved particularly an eye muscle, a stronger eye muscle, to be able to pull their face into a way that looks like they're getting sad puppy dog eyes at you, that they're really, I don't know, winking or something like that. So this seems to be, I mean, it's evolutionarily plausible. Dogs have evolved in this way to connect with us in a better way, and these muscles seem to be indicating that, yes, they are making their face a little bit more like we would want to see.
It's amazing. I thought there was something going on there. Hey, Will, thanks for coming on the show.
No worries, Patricia.
Dr. Will Grant from the Australian National Centre for the Public Awareness of Science.